Hey everyone, welcome back to Medical Mindfield.
By now you should know that I'm Shreya.
And I'm Rachel.
Sorry we forgot to remind you last time.
Today is going to be more informative than usual, because we're seeing a lot of people stress over their medical interviews after applying for 2023.
We haven't done any ourselves, it's a bit too early for us yet. But just to sum up, there are two types of interviews you can get. MMIs,
multiple mini interviews,
and traditional panel interviews.
The multiple mini interviews are different stations which can be interactive scenarios, group work, or even just one-to-one interviews, whilst traditional panel interviews are when you are usually interviewed by 3 to 4 healthcare professionals.
Or even students. Don't worry, we aren't going to bore you with any more details. Instead, we're going to talk about something that comes up in both types of interview, medical ethics.
There are 4 pillars of biomedical ethics: autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. Be sure not to mix up beneficence and maleficence.
I'm not too sure the patients would take that too well. So you might have heard us say some of these in previous episodes, but just to recap, autonomy is the right of a person to make a decision for themselves, especially important when it comes to healthcare.
Beneficence is acting in the best interests of your patient. And non-maleficence means that a doctor has a duty to do no harm to a patient, as well as not letting a patient be harmed through neglect.
Last but definitely not least is justice, meaning that we have to treat all patients equally, and the only thing that can alter a patient's level of priority is how urgent their required treatment is.
Now it's time to dig a bit deeper.
Autonomy isn't as simple as it seems.
Some of you have heard of the term capacity, which means the ability of a person to make a decision for themselves, and this is usually assessed by healthcare professionals with the help of the Mental Capacity Act.
This is for England and Wales. Just note that Scotland uses the Adults with Incapacity Act. Everyone has the right to autonomy. However, if someone lacks capacity when it comes to medicine, they are considered unable to make a decision about their care.
This can be the case for people who suffer from dementia, brain injury, some mental health issues, or people who may be unconscious.
Just because someone has these conditions does not always mean that they lack capacity.
This is because capacity is time and decision specific. So just because someone lacked capacity yesterday doesn't mean they lack capacity today.
And just because they don't have the capacity to refuse life-saving surgery doesn't mean they don't have the capacity to decide what flavour jelly they like.
But sometimes I just can't decide.
So, how do we deem if someone has capacity?
To decide if someone over 16 has capacity under the Mental Capacity Act, they must be able to tick quite a few boxes. Consent isn't as simple as it seems.
They need to understand the question you're asking.
Retain that information and remember the question you have asked them, as well as their own decisions.
Formulate their own decision in their mind and weigh up the options.
And after all of that, communicate their decision back to you.
We always assume that a person has the capacity to make a decision themselves, unless proven otherwise, and wherever possible, you should help a patient fulfill all 4 of these criteria.
For example, a stroke patient may struggle with their speech and not be able to verbally communicate their decision back to you.
But if you gave them a pen and paper to write down their choice, then they can fulfill the 4th criterion, meaning they can communicate their decision, and they can be deemed to have capacity, provided they meet the other 3 criteria.
If someone makes an unwise decision, or one you don't agree with, you can't assume they lack capacity.
And any decision you make on behalf of someone lacking capacity must be in their best interests.
Doctors will often ask family members, but they will make sure that any decisions made have the patient's best interests at heart.
You can also appoint an independent advocate. That's someone who will support a patient to make decisions in certain situations, like serious treatment or times when they'll have significant restrictions placed on their freedoms and rights.
When acting on the behalf of someone lacking capacity, you should consider if there are any less restrictive options.
For example, choosing to put someone on a liquid diet rather than tube feeding.
This is called finding the least restrictive alternative.
However, the final decision must always fulfil the original purpose, so sometimes the least restrictive alternative is not the chosen pathway, if this is in the patient's best interests.
So, we know how to assess capacity in people over 16, but for young people under 16, Gillett competence is used to determine whether they can make decisions about their treatment without their parents' or carers' consent, or in some cases, knowledge.
There is no set definition, but factors that are considered include age, maturity, and mental capacity,
understanding of the issue and what is involved, including advantages, disadvantages, and long-term impacts.
Understanding the risks, implications, and consequences that may arise from their decision.
How well they understand the advice or information given.
Understanding of other options.
And their ability to explain a rationale about their reasoning and decision-making.
And consent is not valid if a young person is being pressured or influenced by someone else.
A lot of ethical cases often set beneficence against autonomy.
Because in some situations, a patient may refuse life-saving surgery, even if it might be in their best interests. But we'll talk more about scenarios a bit later on.
There is an important distinction to be made between beneficence and non-maleficence, as they are not the same thing.
When considering beneficence, you should think about how the patient is feeling and their expectations. What options are available?
How will this impact the patient's life?
Is the action proportionate to the scale of the problem?
It is not as easy as just do good, as what may work for one patient may not work for another one, as everyone is unique.
Here, a biopsychosocial approach,
or holistic,
can be taken to care for the patient as a whole, and not just their condition.
Non-maleficence, or the duty to do no harm, is different from beneficence, as it acts as a threshold for treatment.
If a treatment causes more harm than good, then it's not a viable option.
For example, chemotherapy is known to have a lot of side effects. However, it does do the job of curing cancer. So arguably, curing cancer is better than all the side effects. So it is still used to treat cancer.
But in beneficence, all valid treatment options are considered and rank in order of preference.
Non-maleficence is also a constant medical practice. You shouldn't be causing harm to patients, whereas beneficence tends to be used in response to a specific situation.
Justice embodies one of the core aspects of the NHS, as it was founded to be a free healthcare service for everyone at the point of use, and was only meant to differentiate based on clinical need.
Justice refers to not only abiding by the law, but also to equal treatment of patients.
Like in Scotland, where prescriptions are completely free, so that no one is unfairly discriminated against.
And if you walk into A&E in England, you aren't expected to pay for your care.
Now onto the scenarios. Number one, should people who consume excessive amounts of alcohol be given liver transplants?
Some people believe that as organs for donation are scarce and transplant lists are long, people who drink more alcohol should not be given a liver transplant.
Whilst people who drink large volumes of alcohol regularly tend to have more liver damage, if we look back at justice, we know that it's unfair to discriminate against people simply for their diet, and so we shouldn't deny them potentially life-saving treatment.
Another point to be noted is that for some people, even a small amount of alcohol can lead to the scarring of liver, which can be due to genetics, liver inflammation, or other dietary factors, and so they should not be refused a liver transplant either.
As a doctor, you can't decide whether or not to treat somebody. This is up to the patient alone and whether they would like to help.
Scenario number two. A man you know to be a Jehovah's Witness is unconscious and bleeding out. He is with his wife and you need to decide whether to give him a blood transfusion.
As a bit of background, Jehovah's Witnesses are a branch of Christianity. They believe that humans must not sustain their lives with any creature's blood, and so they may refuse blood transfusions.
Given the circumstances, the man would not have the capacity to consent for a blood transfusion because he's, well, unconscious.
Instead, as a doctor, you would turn to his wife and ask for her consent, as she's likely to have his best interests at heart.
If she were to refuse as well, you'd have to reason with her by explaining the urgency of the situation, as the man's life is at risk.
Ultimately, if she continued to refuse, it would be a tough decision as you would have to choose between beneficence and autonomy of the patient.
Scenario number three. You're a medical student and you find medical equipment from a teaching hospital in your fellow medical student's room. What should you do?
So, although you might think stealing medical equipment is on the less life-threatening side of ethics questions, there are multiple aspects to consider here.
In the first instance, you would ask your peer why they have the medical equipment, as there may be a perfectly reasonable explanation for it, i.e. they might have permission.
If you jumped the gun and reported them, tension might rise between you and unnecessary action will have been taken.
You can then reason with them and ask them to consider the wider implications of their actions. Stealing is firstly unethical.
What if the hospital has a shortage, which puts lives at risk? The equipment can be dangerous, and who would be liable if they seriously hurt themselves?
And you can't threaten your peer. Looks like you're safe now, for now, Shreya. But approaching them in a non-confrontational manner will help defuse the situation.
You could also ask your peer why they felt it necessary to steal the equipment. Were they stressed or anxious about an upcoming exam, and did they want to practice?
As this behaviour is unprofessional, and if they are still refusing to consider any of your points, you can then report them to a faculty member at the medical school.
So, all in all, ethics are quite complicated as there are so many caveats.
So get thinking, and we hope you enjoyed this more informative episode.
Make sure to follow us on Spotify and Instagram so we can
see you next time!